When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength conditioning and strength conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. This is episode 297, and it's a hodgepodge. We've got a research review, some groundbreaking research that we're going to review here. We've got a mystery case. We've got Quack Watch, current headlines, and I'm joined by the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baracchi. What's going on, man?
Hey, sounds like a exciting new format. Nice idea.
I'm exciting. Just generally, I think that's, yeah, it's not my middle name, but we could hyphenate. It could be Philip exciting. I don't know. We'll workshop it a little bit. The PE, I feel like, is not a good like middle abbreviation to have in the medical space, but we'll work on it. How are you, man? You doing all right?
Yeah, I'm doing all right. Still doing my thing in the hospital for this 3-week period. Did a little bit of training earlier today. Did some deadlifting, which has not been a high priority for a while, but it's coming back alive a little bit, and I'm doing that alongside more conditioning than ever. So that's where I'm at currently.
Cardio boys, yeah, real hybrid of you. I learned a valuable lesson, which you would think that I would have known already, but. I played golf with my father. We normally have a standing Wednesday golf date. We play golf together. That's great. I love spending time with my dad. We moved it to Tuesday, which is a training day. And normally what I would try to do is go train before I play golf, just because one, it's like 4.5 hours of just, not high intensity effort, but whatever. I just don't want to train afterwards. It's the time at the end of the day, I'm like, I don't want to do that.
And being in the sun all day is usually tiring as well.
Sure. Yeah. Thermal stress, UV stress, whatever. I don't know. quantify that. But it didn't work out. So I went to train at like 7 p.m. after taking 18,000 steps around the golf course. I also probably shouldn't have walked in hindsight for this. And then I had squats, regular squats, deadlift against bands, split squats, and some hamstring stuff. To say that the RPE went up for a weight that should not have been that high on squats is an understatement. It was like 465. I had 4 sets of 5. And normally that would be like RP 5 or, whatever, just kind of cruising along. It was harder than that. Although the bar speed was like pretty well preserved. It just felt heavy. And I think that's more just like a, if you wanted to say separate central and peripheral fatigue down, I think I was centrally fatigued, and 0 out of 10 would not recommend in hindsight, but I'm here to tell the tale, and just want to tell people that you too can accomplish great things.
Yeah, sounds like you went to war and you won the battle. So carry on.
It's fun. I put the new Taylor Swift. It's not new anymore, but the most recent Taylor Swift album on, and I'm training, and I don't know. I think my face just generally, what is the male equivalent for RBF? Is it RDF? And you guys can figure out the D. Like, because people are like, "What are you listening to, bro? You seem angry." I'm like, "I think it's just my face." It's Taylor. So I'm not hyped up on anything. Anyway, and I don't shout out to Taylor. Like, I don't have anything against you. I don't like your music in particular, but it's mindless background music. Okay,
there you go.
We won't spend too much time talking about top 40 hits on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Instead, let's get into some recent headlines. And I know when you saw this headline, you probably dropped your bowl of oatmeal. Old fashioned oatmeal that you somehow cook in the microwave. So the microwave probably looks like a war zone. Headline reads, "Daily multivitamin supplements don't help you live longer, study shows." That's from ABC, as I recall. Did you see this headline that came out?
I certainly have seen this headline. I can't say that I dove into it a whole lot further. It sounds like you did. This is at least an unsurprising headline, or also an one that is unlikely to materially impact my recommendations day to day. But tell us what you think.
Well, yeah, I mean, like when I saw it initially, I'm like, yeah, I've been saying that for like a while. Okay, but thanks, I guess. And so now I decided to dig into the study. Interestingly, so you go to these mainstream media websites and whatever, they're collecting that ad revenue, and no shade on that. But I'm just like, hey, do a good job when you're linking, you know, to the study. Like it should be in the first, you know, few sentences. These idiots linked it to the editorial comment, not the actual study. So I had to do some more digging. You know, I'm like, thanks a lot, guys. So anyway, this was an NIH study, so National Institutes of Health, and it was published June 26th, 2024, which quite recent. They took three separate data sets and combined them. One was a group of AARP members that were already enrolled in another NIH study. The second group was from the PLCO cancer trials. That's prostate, lung, colorectal, and ovarian cancer trial. And then the third group was the agricultural health study group. These were pesticide applicators and their spouses. So the data collection started in the mid-1990s, and they were continued up until basically the start of COVID, so late 2019, early 2020. Just about 400,000 subjects. The average age was about 61 and a half, and 55% were male. And they categorized these folks into three separate groups. So either non-users of multivitamins, non-daily users of multivitamins, so just, I guess, periodic use, and then daily users of multivitamins. They tried to adjust for confounders through some fancy statistical modeling about, you know, did it matter what their sex was, what their socioeconomic status was, education level, BMI, physical activity level. The healthy eating index made another appearance here, family history of cancer, and so on, which I actually thought, you know, I'm not a statistical whiz. And if you ask me to control for all of those variables, I'd say, let's outsource this. I have no idea how to do that, but at least you tried. The primary outcome was mortality, so death. And basically what they found is there was an increased mortality for daily multivitamin use compared to non-users. And the effect size was about 5% increase in risk of mortality compared to not using a multivitamin, which I found interesting. I guess my party line the whole time had been that multivitamins are probably net neutral, if anything. Outside the risk of maybe contamination, for example. But it'd be really hard to ascribe, you know, harm from multivitamin use. It's just, I don't think they do anything outside of like pretty selective populations that we'll discuss here shortly. So to find that there was like an actual increase in risk in this big of a data set, and they tried to adjust the best, you know, for all these confounders, I'm like, maybe that makes my recommendation against multivitamin use a little bit stronger. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree with you for most vitamins that they are most likely to be net neutral and essentially not terribly helpful. There are some, though, this is not the first time that the idea of a possibility of harm has been described. If you look in the literature, particularly around use of things like vitamin E and beta carotene in the context of, I believe, lung cancer is one example, particularly supplemental vitamin E, not necessarily like dietary vitamin E, but that's a little bit of a more well-known example of a scenario where vitamin E supplementation appeared to actually cause harm and is specifically recommended against, for example, by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. So it is not unheard of for a particular vitamin, mineral, nutrient type thing when taken in supplemental form to actually have harm, even outside of the context of like supplement purity, for example, or some kind of like drug-drug interaction or something like that. So it's plausible. I think that, you know, I don't know about how confident I would be in the effect, the actual effect measurement here in terms of like that magnitude of effect, given that this is not a randomized trial and you know, they do the best they can controlling for a lot of things, but there's essentially always going to be some unmeasured differences between the groups. So I think that the possibility of an effect remains plausible to me. The directionality of effect is similarly plausible to me. The magnitude of that effect, I am not at all confident in. I think that would be my probable take home from this.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think, you know, something that's maybe lost when people are, you know, considering taking a multivitamin or buying one. I don't know. I get it that people get motivated. They want to take charge of their health trajectory. And they're like, yeah, multivitamin seems fine. You know, 1/3 approximately of the adults in the United States take a multivitamin. 1/4 of children and adolescents take a multivitamin in the United States. It's an $8 billion industry in the United States as of 2020, representing close to 15% of all supplements, you know, a lot of people are taking these things. And I think the idea is like, well, if let's say, I don't know, you hear that vitamin D is good, right, in general, or vitamin D is associated with all these particular disease states. And you're like, well, I can take a multivitamin that's got vitamin D in it, and great, that's good, right? It's going to be beneficial. It's just like, oh, if, you know, not having this thing is bad and I can supplement it via a, you know, a pill, that's good. But there's a lot more nuance here, unfortunately. And some of this is due to like reverse causality, you know, in the case of vitamin D, for example. But another thing is the food matrix effect that we've kind of referred to in passing a number of times, where the specific micronutrient, whether it's a vitamin, whether it's a particular molecule or some other sort of compound in a food, is found to be like beneficial. And then people try to isolate it and then supplement it. You know, greens supplements, for example, are notorious for this. But you're missing the rest of the food. And it seems like the food and its, you know, the sum of all of its parts are greater than the individual things that taking in isolation. So I think overall, the headline wasn't surprising to me, other than the fact they found like, hey, maybe there's an increased risk. And that to me was a little bit more surprising, but it doesn't really change my recommendation. But there are some folks, and we've discussed this in a previous podcast, episode 185, I've linked in the description below, about multivitamins, who may actually benefit from actually taking a multivitamin, although your doctor likely would have recommended it. So for example, people like the prenatal vitamin, I think you and I would both be like, yeah, this is likely to be beneficial in a prenatal setting, a prenatal vitamin. Those with malabsorptive disorders, whether that's some sort of issue with the gut, they've had surgery before, they have some sort of issue with absorbing food, likely to have been recommended a multivitamin. Alcohol use disorder, other people who have poor intake of food. So whether that's due to like a functional disorder, they just have difficulties eating or otherwise are not eating very much. Those folks are likely to benefit from a multivitamin, and even conditions like REDS, so that relative energy deficiency in sports, stuff like that. Those are all, it's likely to probable that they're going to benefit from a multivitamin. Whereas people who take multivitamins who are otherwise healthy, I don't think that there's likely to be a net benefit. And in fact, I might start leaning more towards net harm, depending on the formulation of the multivitamin mix.
Yeah, people might be surprised to hear me say that I start vitamins on people all the time. But the reason for that is I work in the inpatient setting in the hospital, where the types of folks that I see are those who have, for example, those malabsorptive type disorders, who have had, you know, significant gut surgery, who have heavy alcohol use issues and other signs of malnutrition, who are, you know, dying from something else that basically saps their appetite so they don't eat anything, and then they can have life-threatening deficiencies from things. So yeah, I use them a lot, but it's in those particular risk groups. It's not in, you know, a run-of-the-mill, healthy outpatient with no complaints that I'm recommending to take one of these things.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, again, I think when I read the headline, I was like, yeah, duh. But then the maybe negative kind of impact, I was like, let's look a little closer into this. So for those who are interested, I've linked the complete paper, not just the editorial, because I'm better than ABC. I want you guys to know that. In the show notes, also our previous podcast on this is episode 185, and that is filled with other references. Just the last thing, people will talk about, oh, vitamin use, multivitamin use, and like exercise. Well, come on, we're sweating a lot. We're exerting our bodies. We're going to war. Must take a multivitamin. But to the extent it's actually been assessed, there's no real benefit on exercise-related performance outside of the setting of REDS, for example. And that even goes down to like single vitamin a supplementation like vitamin D. So we have another podcast on that, but I think that puts a nice little bow on that topic. All right, let's transition into some of the other segments in this particular podcast. First up, mystery case. Oh. I know you guys love this, so Austin.
We did get peppered with some requests for when the next case files was going to be, so I guess we're going to tease them with one here. Let's do it.
Yeah, and so I think people, you know, I haven't got any direct feedback on this, but I think people enjoy me predicting whether or not you're going to get this. I do think that you're going to get this, but I also would like to receive credit for not giving you some of the most esoteric cases that I've come across. Basically, if I see a case and I have no idea what that actual medical condition is, I'm not suggesting that if I don't know what it is, you don't know what it is. That's not what I'm saying.
Sure.
But if I've never heard of the thing, I do think it's going to be more difficult for you to arrive at that particular answer. Anyway.
But as we say, when we do these exercises, it's not necessarily always about the journey, but the discussion can be enjoyable too. So
Wow.
I'll leave it up to your judgment. It's the friends we made along the way.
That's right. Yeah, there you go. All right. Mystery case time. Here we go. Starting as always with the presentation. And just as a reminder to folks at home, this is a real case. So it's been documented in the medical literature as a real person. So if we do make jokes, we're not trying to make jokes in light of the person or their experience, but some educational humor along the way, perhaps. So real case. This is an 18-year-old male skier. He presents to the clinic as a referral from orthopedic surgery for the evaluation of a one-month history of worsening fatigue, depressed mood, inattention, and dizziness upon standing when going to the bathroom at night. 3 months prior to this transfer, he was quarantined in a hotel room for 2 weeks after returning from international travel, secondary to concerns for COVID-19 infection. After this two-week period, he began a new training plan that, per the patient, was much higher in intensity and volume. He says after about the first week, the new training program was about twice as much as he used to do. He denies any changes in weight, though he does say that he's on a calorie-controlled diet to keep his weight in check for sport. His review of symptoms, which is basically when you ask the patient head to toe, hey, do you have any of these other symptoms? His review of symptoms was otherwise negative, including no headache, no visual field defects, or loss of libido. He denies any drug use or medication use, including performance-enhancing drugs. So before we go any further, just after hearing that, any spidey senses tingling, any sort of general thought process going on there?
Sure. So you have a young athlete skier who is coming in, you said, with a month of fatigue, low mood, inattention, and some dizziness on standing. And so, we're obviously going to get a bit more information, but the chief concern of fatigue is one that is A, super common, and B, super what we call nonspecific, meaning it doesn't point you to any one particular organ system or raise concern for specific organ systems because there's so many different things that can do it. We also have a decrease in his mood, which can come from, primarily psychiatric disorders, but underlying medical issues as well can manifest in this way. Inattention is also a bit tougher of a symptom to explain from a medical standpoint outside of like a diagnosis of delirium, like we talked about last time, and is more often going to fall in the psychiatric realm. And then dizziness on standing, that kind of lightheadedness feeling called what we call orthostasis, is also super common and can come from various issues relating to your blood volume, to endocrine issues, cardiovascular issues, neurological issues, things like that. So the point I'm making in this summary is that we have a whole bunch of very nonspecific symptoms. If he said, this fatigue, it could be something, a psychiatric manifestation. It could be a neurologic manifestation. It could be a sleep disorder. I mean, we've talked before when we have patients who say that they're fatigued, usually my first question to them is, tell me about your sleep. There are endocrine or hormone related disorders, for example, related to the thyroid gland, related to the adrenal gland, or related to the gonads in the form of hypogonadism. All of which can manifest with a lot of these things. And then the other kind of remaining, medical issues that you start to think about is there some evidence of inflammation to raise suspicion for like an autoimmune type condition, a chronic infection of some kind, given how long this has been going on? And so I'm just notice how I'm just kind of putting out very broad general categories at this point of the types of pathologies that can lead to this rather than pointing to very specific diagnoses. That's like an important thing to not jump too far too soon. As far as the other information that you gave, there was this quarantine for COVID. It's unclear whether he actually had COVID or not. If he has some kind of a post-viral syndrome, if he did have a COVID infection, that can manifest with this. A lot of people hear about quote unquote long COVID, which is admittedly a super nebulous syndrome that is an active area of research, but all viral illnesses pretty much can cause a kind of a post-viral syndrome with this type of nonspecific symptom. And then you mentioned his training plan with higher intensity. I mean, a run-of-the-mill kind of overtraining syndrome can manifest with, again, all of these types of symptoms. I would want to just do a bit more thorough dig and make sure there's not any of these other medical things that I'd want to catch. And then the last thing I'll say is that the last few kind of pertinent symptoms that you mentioned, he has no headache or visual changes or loss of libido. All of those things can relate to, for example, a diagnosis of hypogonadism or, if he's had head trauma as a skier and got a concussion and TBI, that can manifest with a lot of these types of symptoms. And then he's not on any performance enhancing drugs per his history, in terms of if he'd been on steroids and then stopped them abruptly and he's left hypogonadal afterwards. So that's kind of what the information that you told me does for me so far, but I'm still staying super broad in general until I get more information, data, exam, et cetera.
Yeah, and we'll get to that. Just a brief aside, in reading case reports, I am left often unsatisfied with not only the history that's provided, but also like the exam notes. So look, if you're listening to this and you're thinking about writing up a case report, I encourage you to do so. We, the royal we, the medical community at large, wants you to write up the case report. But just, hey, put everything in there. You don't have
I'll tell you the problem, because I've been involved in publishing case reports. Oftentimes, there's unfortunately a word count limit, which can make it tough. So that might be why you're seeing some of this. I've had to trim down a lot of my trainees' case reports when they get a little enthusiastic with some of their writing. That might explain your dissatisfaction.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I remain unsatisfied. I demand satisfaction. Okay. Let's get to the exam here. And, with that, little foreshadowing. Not a ton of information here to share with you, but apparently maybe the pertinent things.
Sure.
So his physical exam overall is unremarkable. He does appear his stated age and is well-developed. The examiner said that he was somewhere between Tanner stage 4 and Tanner stage 5, so appropriately developed.
Okay,
at that point.
That helps.
yeah. You're like, wait.
I forget that.
I thought when I said 18-year-old male, you'd be like, it's borderline peds. Let's get peds on the phone. His BMI is 21.4. They did a very focused gonadal sort of assessment. He had normal gonadal development based on testicular volume, size, appearance, body hair distribution, etc. But otherwise, yeah, vital signs, temperature, everything within normal limits, and physical exam overall unremarkable. So I'm going to give you some lab information here, and I've pared this down because the labs they sent off were quite extensive.
Really? That's surprising, but okay.
Yeah, so we're going to start with what everybody wants to know. What is this young man's testosterone level? And his total testosterone level is 43 nanograms per deciliter, which is far below the lower limit, which is usually somewhere, depending on the lab, 200 to 300 nanograms per deciliter, maybe somewhere in between there, depends on the lab again. They also got an LH, luteinizing hormone, and FSH, follicle stimulating hormone. We use those to kind of figure out, well, if they have low testosterone, maybe why? And his LH was normal, but low, 1.6, whereas the normal range is between 1.24 and 8.6. His FSH was also normal, but towards the lower end, where the normal range is 1.27 to 19.25. They did a lot of thyroid evaluation here. His T3 was low, below normal limits. His free T3 was also below normal limits. His TSH was also below normal limits, 0.55. His free T4 and T4 were otherwise normal. Growth hormone, IGF-1, cortisol, they did the ACTH stimulation test. That was all normal. No other labs are currently available. There's some other testing that I will inform you of after this, but just based on that sort of laboratory analysis, anything kicking into gear there in your brain?
Sure. So I just want to confirm that I heard everything correctly. So we have a very low testosterone level at 43, and that would be pathologically low, whether or not the lab was collected correctly. We've talked about this a lot before, like 8 to 10 a.m. ideally, fasted, all this other kind of stuff. And even if you didn't collect it in that perfect way, it should not really be this low in pretty much anybody. So definite hypogonadism here. The next thing I heard was that his gonadotropins, the LH and FSH, were both like low normal. Is that right? Okay.
Yep.
So in that situation, the first thought that you have is, well, if somebody's testosterone is low, their testes are not producing it, your body should react to that by cranking up LH and FSH to tell the testes to, hey, make more testosterone and let's normalize this level, bring it back into equilibrium. So if the LH and FSH levels are normal, that is actually abnormal, which can be a tricky concept. So they should be very, very high, but they are not. And so that they are not localizes some kind of a problem up to the pituitary gland where these originate from in order to then stimulate the testes. So I'm starting to get suspicious about something kind of central up in the brain. If I heard correctly on the thyroid tests, they measured T3 levels, which is a complicated thing that I'm not going to get into right now, but all of his T3 measurements were low. Is that correct?
Below normal, yep.
And his TSH, you said, was also low. Is that correct?
Yep.
So a little bit oddly, I think you told me his free T4 was normal somehow.
Correct.
Okay. So that's a little bit unusual. But if somebody has low thyroid hormone levels, then similarly, your thyroid stimulating hormone should increase to stimulate your thyroid gland to make more hormone. When the levels are low and your thyroid stimulating hormone is similarly low, then that starts to also raise concerns for, is there a problem with the site of TSH production? which is also the pituitary gland. Theoretically, you could also have a problem even higher up in the brain, like in the hypothalamus, which is kind of pretty uncommon, but not impossible, to where like nothing in the whole axis is telling the next step down to do its job. That would be a very rare type of a syndrome. Interestingly, the other hormones that you mentioned, the growth hormone and IGF-1, which the IGF-1 comes out later on, but the growth hormone and the cortisol were all normal. Is that right? So his ACTH axis to stimulate his cortisol is functioning. The growth hormone axis to stimulate IGF-1 production are normal. And so, we have these different types of cells in the pituitary gland that can each produce these individual hormones. And so some of these seem to be doing their job, and others are either suppressed or are not doing their job for some reason, which can totally happen. You can have kind of selective deficiencies of one or the other. If there is just a complete death of your whole pituitary gland, or it's surgically removed, or, you know, it hemorrhages or infarcts or a tumor that knocks out the whole thing, then you would lose all these hormones. And that is something that would be very dangerous. But he seems to have just a few that are not functioning properly. So at the moment, you know, I suspect that he underwent some brain imaging, to evaluate these axes, higher up in the brain, including pituitary and hypothalamus. And then if you were to find a problem there, then you could take that further. Other ways that stuff like this can happen, for example, aside from that, so that testosterone profile, low testosterone and low gonadotropins, is what we call secondary hypogonadism. We can see that in patients who, for example, have obesity, those who have bad sleep apnea, those who are on chronic opioids. It can kind of suppress that axis starting from higher up. Those things you don't typically expect to cause secondary hypothyroidism like this, where if the thyroid hormones are in fact low and the TSH is low, that would be unusual to come from those types of things. The only thing that's confusing me a little bit was how he has normal T4 levels, unless he's somehow taking it, it's in a supplement, it's contaminated, or the only other explanation for that would actually be, I suppose, some sort of subclinical hyperthyroidism, which doesn't fit this case at all. So I'll leave that aside for now.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get some more laboratory information and some imaging. So they did a DEXA scan on this young man. They found out his body fat was 9.7% on DEXA, but his bone mineral density was normal. He had a brain MRI, was also normal. They did a GnRH stimulation test, which produced an LH level that was 10x his above normal. And then they subsequently went down the road of like some dietary investigation, found out his calorie intake was about 2,300 calories per day, 115 grams of protein, 80 grams of fat, 280 grams of carbohydrates. They estimated that his daily energy expenditure was close to 3,800 calories per day, but he wasn't losing any, had not reported any weight loss. And that is the data that you have to work with to come up with a diagnosis, unfortunately.
So if I heard that last part correctly, it seems like most of the other testing that was done was pretty normal. He is relatively lean. He has good bone mineral density. He doesn't have a brain tumor, a brain mass, an infarct or stroke or anything like that of any of the pertinent kind of territories in his brain. And then a GnRH stim test basically is giving him the hormone that originates from even higher in the brain in the hypothalamus to see if I give you this, can your pituitary generate the hormones that it needs to then trigger the testes to make what they need to make. And so if you had, you know, something severely impairing the cells of your pituitary from functioning, like an infarct or a hemorrhage or apoplexy or any of those sorts of things, or if it was severely suppressed, then you would have a tough time stimulating it. So it sounds like he had a normal, I'm going to assume that 10x is a plenty adequate, you know, response to stimulating his pituitary gland, which is reassuring. And it suggests that his pituitary is in fact like anatomically and functionally okay. It may perhaps be lacking stimulus from even higher up, for example, from the hypothalamus, which is an interesting and, as I said, uncommon kind of scenario. And so if we have that, now we're like maybe up to like this tertiary level way up high in the brain, and his brain MRI is normal, meaning there's not a structural reason. He hasn't had, again, any of the things that can impact your brain radiation, you know, sarcoidosis, all sorts of, you know, weird stuff like that. And then the last piece of data that you gave me is it sounds like they estimated his calorie expenditure at like just under 4,000 calories a day, and he's consuming just over 2,000 calories a day. So he's likely undernourished, in which case that would certainly raise suspicion for these endocrine abnormalities arising from something like relative energy deficiency in sport syndrome or REDS that you alluded to earlier, which can just, you know, it's almost adaptive what his body is doing, turning down all of these things, because if we barely have enough energy to like operate our body, then we need to slow down metabolic rate. So the thyroid axis gets turned down, the androgen testosterone axis, reproduction, all of that kind of stuff gets turned down because, hey, we can't afford to do this stuff. So it's actually like could be a physiologically appropriate adaptive response to undernutrition in his case. So I'd be curious, in the same way that they did a stim test to see if they could stimulate his pituitary to do its thing, I would do a calorie stim test and see if feeding this boy can get him back on track.
Yeah. And like I said, I was pretty sure you're going to get it. They did diagnose this gentleman with REDS, relative energy deficiency in sport. This is a term they used to replace the female athlete triad that they used historically up until, I believe, like 2014, because apparently this can happen in men. Now, the interesting part of this case is that most REDS cases and previously female athlete triad cases were in endurance athletes. And this person is definitively not an endurance athlete. There also have been some case reports in like natural bodybuilders who have had like REDS type syndrome. Obviously, if you're on androgens, you might be masking that by supplementing with the androgens. But yeah, this guy felt like crap. Basically was like, hey, dude, what's going on? It turns out it looked like it was REDS. So what they did to this individual, they sent him to consult with a registered dietitian, a sports dietitian, and they increased his calorie intake. They reduced his training down and effectively resolved all of his symptoms. And so this is an important thing because it has been reported that the REDS sort of incidence is pretty high in sport. And we think this is due to low energy availability of chronically, not just like a day of under eating or 2 days of under eating, but like chronically. And as you pointed out so eloquently, it seems like the body adapts to this to otherwise maintain some level of performance and function, because that's what we're designed to do. If we, you know, design, I don't want to make that word use
too, heavy air do, quotes. There.
Yeah. Do too much heavy lifting. But you know, the whole point is like, if our purpose on this planet is really to like pass on our genes, that sort of definition of fitness, and like be able to procure food so we don't, you know, perish. Well, we need to maintain some level of function, cognition, et cetera. Even during periods of low energy availability. Well, this seems to be adaptive. And it's been reported that the risk of low energy availability is close to or up to like 60% in sports, particularly those that emphasize leanness or weight class sports being at the highest risk. And yes, females tend to be more affected on this, and that may be due to the sports that are like kind of available to them. But yeah, the prevalence in men is also increasing. We just don't really have a lot of good data on this because it's underreported. But this prolonged state of energy deficiency often has negative side effects on many systems, including higher risk of bony stress fractures. That's why they did the DEXA scan. Overall injury risk, fatigue, and poor performance. And so I don't want people to take away from this like, oh yeah, if I eat, you know, under eat for a few days, like my performance is going to be in the trash can. But we're not talking about a few days of low energy availability. We're talking again, like weeks, months, longer of low energy availability relative to what you need to kind of thrive, not just survive.
Yeah. And it's that chronic under eating. It's not in the context of you, you do some squat, bench, and deadlift 3 times a week. Like it is also in the context of like a lot of training in terms of volume and intensity, or the product of the two.
Yeah, which is why this is mostly described in like ultra endurance sports and right. those types of things, or other sports that have high amounts of like practice and training volume, and not generally in like strength sports, strength power sports. So for the professionals at home, there is a really cool clinical assessment tool called REDS CAT. It's used for not only screening and treatment, but also return to play criteria. It uses a traffic light system. So red being high risk, yellow, intermediate risk, green, they're good to go, return to sport. really important when dealing with individuals who you have a concern with for REDS is to develop a therapeutic alliance, because, you know, people don't just do this by happenstance in general, as far as like restricting their food to maintain a particular body weight or body composition. It's usually something that's been learned or incentivized on some level. And so the treatment of this, of REDS, involves a multidisciplinary approach, usually with the registered dietitian, usually with the coach, usually with parents and younger individuals. And the goal is to increase energy availability and energy intake, and typically decreasing exercise-related energy expenditure. And sometimes that's got to do both things to get folks back on track. There's been some like objective sort of targets that have been published with respect to energy intake level per kilogram of lean body mass, which brings into like other problems. How do you assess people for like what's their fat-free mass? But in the literature right now, there seems to be this threshold of 30 kilocalories per kilogram fat-free mass for women that has also been applied to men, but has not yet been validated. And so there's these targets of like, hey, what if you know what your, you know, lean body mass is, get it at least 30 calories per kilo lean body mass. That's like, you got to be above that. And if you're below that, your risk goes up by a lot for REDS. So I've linked not only the case report, but also the screening tool and some other information from the British, British Medical Journal, British Sports Medicine Journal on REDS. So check that out if you're a fitness and or health professional and you are interested in REDS. So yeah, and in some ways you prompted me to talk about REDS with the cryptic text. Hey dude, we ever talked about REDS on the podcast? But also then the multivitamin thing is a perfect sure. setup.
Yeah.
So this is also a perfect setup. As we transition into Quack Watch, it's been a minute, and I've just made the executive decision to not name the person that we're talking about, just because I don't necessarily want to be adversarial towards anybody, because sure. I don't think anybody's out to harm folks on purpose. And two, I do believe that a lot of times people have misunderstandings that are, again, not nefarious. And they're just like, hey, here's what I'm thinking. And they just put it out on the internet. And subsequently, I take a look. So I'm just going to quote this. This individual says, "What makes no sense to me, the lack of focus on brain health during preps/fat loss phases. The brain uses up to 25% of calories per day. As soon as it stops working so much, and there's tons of signs that its output is dropping, you stop burning as many calories on the day. A lot of brain dead people on prep," referring to like bodybuilding prep. "And you have to make that up with cardio, steps, and fat burners. Keep the brain healthy and functional equals easier fat loss. Bonus, less emotional stress too equals easier fat loss." So Austin, just like right off the tip, any reaction to that?
Yeah, a couple things, I guess. The first is our usual just like, there's no definition of what exactly is meant by brain health here. The other interesting thing is that there's a grain of truth here, in the sense that when we've talked before about, you know, the approach to managing obesity and appetite, you know, kind of regulation, quote unquote, to the extent that our appetite systems are, you know, regulated by various parts of our brain or influenced by various parts of our brain. And so we've talked, for example, before about how if you're sleep restricted, appetite tends to be higher and you tend to get less full from meals. And that tends to promote a spontaneous increase in calorie intake. We've talked about how when people are stressed, of course, there's a subset of people for whom stress tends to increase appetite and decrease satiety, leading to a spontaneous increase in calorie intake. Of course, there's another group of people for whom stress tends to sap their appetite. So just kind of an individual response there. But there's various kind of neuropsychiatric sorts of influences on things like appetite and satiety. So that's kind of like the grain of truth that I'm seeing here, through, even though the bigger picture here is like, dude, what do you, or ma'am, what do you mean by brain health? And then finally, you know, when it comes to the last part where they're just like, keep the brain healthy and functional, how?
Right.
Like, what exactly do you think that I should be doing that I'm not doing right now?
Yeah, a couple things I took away from this was that, one, the idea that somehow like brain metabolic rate drops during periods of low energy availability, which we kind of just discussed, like its terminal endpoint, REDS, for example. So that's thing one. And then thing two, that there's something you could do about it that doesn't require like adding more energy. You know, like, so to my knowledge, there's never been a paper or like controlled experiment showing that the brain's metabolic rate goes down significantly during periods of low energy availability. And this can be during, you know, active fat loss phases that you see clinically, or even more extreme fat loss phases. So like, remember the guy, Barbieri, who did the, you know, over a year long fast, you know, they regularly had him take cognitive assessments, and he was, you know, fine throughout despite having effectively no calories throughout. So, you know, what happens, you do have adaptive responses to energy deficits, low energy availability, and the magnitude by which those adaptations can occur, well, depends on not only the magnitude of the energy deficit, larger deficits generally cause larger adaptations, but also an individual's genetics. So some people, when, you know, exposed to an energy deficit to presumably lose weight, whether intentional or not, they will see a massive slowing in not only the energy expenditure from activity, but they'll also be less active, particularly like spontaneous movements. So even if they're exercising the same, they'll burn less calories during that exercise and then be less active outside of that formal exercise. Their energy expenditure related to digesting, metabolizing, storing food can also change and be lowered. And your resting metabolic rate can go down, not usually through the brain's metabolic rate, but through things we just saw in our case of Rett's. So various endocrine sort of systems can be shut down. Immunological related function can be depressed. A whole host of things. But in general, your body's really good at keeping two organs going. One is your brain. The second is your heart. Because again, our purpose, if we have one here on the planet, is to like consume resources and reproduce. So if your brain and your heart don't work, right, and to the next extent, your musculoskeletal system doesn't work, well, it's really difficult to interact with the environment, consume resources, and then reproduce. And so from an evolutionary standpoint, you'd want to preserve those as long as possible, even during periods of famine or sustained low energy availability. And then the last part is like, oh, you could potentially do something about your brain's dropping metabolic rate. And outside of like a coma that has a reversible like cause, or other sort of like a neurological problem has a reversible cause, the answer to that is no. Your body is much smarter and has redundant multiple mechanisms that will prevent you from screwing it up. Most of the time, you have to try really hard to screw it up. And some people are successful in that. So I don't know. I guess my take home for this is that, yes, the body can adapt to energy deficits. That amount of adaptation is going to be proportional to not only the deficit, but also related to the person's genetics. We don't think that this involves the brain until you reach very low energy availability sustained for long periods of time. But in that case, you really have no choice but otherwise to like increase energy availability, because no amount of steps, fat burners, you know, whatever are going to like not only keep you losing weight, your body will defend against that to keep itself alive. But also it's not going to clear up this sort of brain fog that you might have, or cognitive impairment. Just, you know, we just literally just talked about this case. So anything else you want to add to this outside? I think you put it, you pointed out nicely that, yeah, if you're stressed or, you know, you have other things going on, it can affect your appetite and satiety, and to that extent, you know, controls your overall energy intake. Well, yeah, these things are related. So,
yeah. Did you get this from Threads, or where did this come from? It's like a cesspool of dumb takes.
Dude, I don't, you know, I'm trying to rate these things like social media on like bad takes, right? Yeah. And I think my problem is that I don't follow anyone on Threads because I haven't spent enough time on that particular app. So it just feeds me stuff that I think they've seen I've interacted with before.
Yeah. Yeah.
It all happens to be bad takes.
It's so dumb.
What do you think is worse, YouTube comments or Threads?
Probably YouTube, just because it's a much broader swath of of humanity, which on average is.
Yeah. X and YouTube are pretty, they're up there for sure. Threads is, you know, there's less people, but maybe it's a, you know, self-selection bias of worse takes. I don't know. TBD, we'll come back to this. Okay. Look, we got two papers to talk about. One, Austin, I have to ask you on this particular paper, you have to prevent me from going off on a tangent and a rant about how upset I am with this. Okay, let's talk about it. So that is your duty. You have to do this. So this is a new USPSTF, so United States Preventative Services Task Force evidence report titled Interventions to Prevent Falls in Older Adults. This was published in the beginning of June in JAMA. So, you know, it's got all the makings of a great paper, right? USPSTF evidence report, JAMA publication, preventing falls, and they're talking about exercise. You would think, oh, if there was some excitement to be had around a paper, that this would be the one, but it just pissed me off. So let's get a little background here. falls are the leading cause of unintentional injury and death for adults 65 years or older in the United States. Over a quarter of older adults in the community report one fall each year, and 10% report an injury from one of those falls. Both the rate of falls and fall-related deaths have been increasing, so what do? In 2018, the USPSTF came out with some guidelines that recommended exercise for fall prevention, amongst other interventions. And this is an update on just the exercise portion of that. They had previously recommended against like vitamin D and calcium and community-dwelling adults. They don't address that in this particular paper. It's just on exercise. And so again, we're barbell medicine. We want to promote exercise in the community. Preventing falls is, you know, along with that. So we should be excited about this. But again, it just pissed me off. So the study, again, it's a review of studies. So basically a meta-analysis. They took 37 studies and they looked at exercise interventions to prevent falls, injuries from falls, and so on. Just over 16,000 subjects in these 37 studies. About half of the studies were new compared to the 2018 guidelines that they published. The average age ranged from 68 to 88 in these studies, and over half of the participants were deemed to be at increased risk of falling. So they either had a history of falls or some other risk factor. And so if you had to predict like who's going to benefit the most from an exercise intervention, it would be those at the highest risk. Just logically, that makes sense, although sometimes our logic tends to fail. You can make the alternative argument that if you are at high risk of falling already, well, maybe it's too late. We can't really do much with the exercise. Now, just as, again, a little foreshadowing, the exercise interventions were all over the place. Some were just walking for 30 minutes. Others were home physical therapy of unknown sort of, you know, quality and quantity. Some were Tai Chi, less than a handful. And I tried to pull as many of these studies as I could just to see, like, is anybody actually lifting weights, like meaningful weights? And, you know, of the 20-something studies I pulled, nobody lifted anything of consequence, meaning like, oh, they were on like a, you know, a selectorized machine, you know, training to near failure. Are they certain? Nobody's lifting barbells for sure. Not to say that barbells have this unique sort of quality, but still, like, it needs to be dosed appropriately, I feel like, in order to call it resistance training. I digress. All these studies did have control groups, which received either usual care or like the flippant advice to, hey, you should maybe exercise more. And they just compared outcomes. Now, the results of this meta-analysis were that there was a reduction in the risk of the first fall and a first fall resulting in injury by about 15%, although there was no real effect on secondary falls or injury risk from a second fall if somebody already had one. And per 1,000 people, you would basically prevent just over 100 falls and about 25-ish injuries. Relatively little adverse effects during exercise, mostly soreness, which you would kind of expect. But a few falls did happen in some of the studies. One resulted in a wrist fracture and one resulted in a hip fracture.
Yikes.
Which 0 out of 10 would not recommend. And so the take home here, you know, to their credit, they say, hey, we recommend exercise interventions to prevent falls in community dwelling adults 65 years or older who are at increased risk of falls. But the effect, particularly in preventing secondary falls, was not statistically significant. And so overall exercise seemed to demonstrate a benefit of modest sort of value. And that's kind of what their current guideline is. And I just am like, man, this is due to the data not being great because you're not using a good intervention, or at least what we would predict to be a good intervention. So like if it were me and I had all the money in the world, what would I do? I would say, hey, look, we're going to have a big study or a series of studies where you're actually lifting real weights. You know, it's supervised. We're making sure that you get somewhere near failure, loading you appropriately based on your current fitness levels, mobility levels, functional ability, et cetera. And we're going to follow you for a long period of time. But that's not what these people are doing. They're doing TheraBand exercises, Tai Chi. Nothing against Tai Chi, but if I was trying to prevent falls, I don't know that Tai Chi would be my go-to modality any more than I would like, you know, aquatic-based sort of therapy, you know? And I don't know. So I'm just a little angry, I guess, at the current state of the evidence. Like if in 2018, so 6 years ago, we said, hey, exercise is probably pretty good at reducing falls. Let's study this some more over the next few years. Commission a damn study where people are actually lifting weights. And if multiple studies show, hey, no real benefit to like, you know, lifting real weights as Dr. Feigenbaum defines it. Well, fine, I'll shut up then. You know, it's totally possible that if you catch this too late or you don't have enough long enough duration of exposure to the intervention, maybe it doesn't make a difference. I'm willing to accept that. but I'm not willing to accept substandard data that continues to get funded. And I'll just, I want to say more, but I think that's where I stand.
Yeah, I think you make a few good points. It sounds like you're putting just too many, you're throwing too much stuff in the pot. You have a diverse group of subjects at varying kind of points along the, you know, strength span trajectory, to like make up a term there. And then you're applying varied interventions to them at varied and generally low doses. And presumably with like varying amounts of follow-up and things like that. And so if I'm to like Mad Lib this into a different type of study, say you took, you know, people at a wide spectrum of like how many decades they've had diabetes or something like that, and then you apply an intervention to this very diverse population, and they're to take like 1 milligram of metformin or 1 unit of insulin or a microgram of empagliflozin or something like just very underdosed interventions, varied interventions to a population at varying points along the disease, you know, spectrum, I would be very unsurprised to see underwhelming results from such a study. Yeah. And so that's kind of the way I'm thinking about this. Or same if you gave people 1 milligram of lisinopril or 1 microgram of metoprolol, like, you know, you're going to see, you know, not particularly significant. If you're going to conclude that, hey, maybe blood pressure medicines don't work very well. And it's like, don't they? Or is it a dosage question and the population to which it's being applied and the outcome being measured and at what time point and et cetera. So that's part of the problem with just like, you know, huge data sets. They're attractive because it's like, man, we have so much statistical power to draw conclusions out of it. But depending on how varied the information is that you're putting into it, it can just make everything super murky.
Yeah. I mean, we talk about like pack year history when it comes to like smoking exposure. So like how much do people smoke and for how long they've been doing it? BMI years is like something that's kind of like coming into like, oh, how long has a person had excess adiposity and to what extent? How about strength years? Like how long you've been strong, you know, and how strong were you?
Yeah.
I think that would be a more interesting study. And if this is such a big problem, falls are the leading cause of unintentional injury and death in people over the age of 65, well, damn it, study it. You know, because imagine you're a clinician, right? And you read this and you're like, okay, it's like modest results. Like how much does that motivate you to recommend exercise to your patients, and not just walking more or Tai Chi, again, no shade to Tai Chi or whatever, but like lifting weights. It's just not. And we're already having a tough enough time getting providers to discuss exercise or refer people to exercise professionals. This isn't helping. I feel like, I don't know. I mean, there are problems with implementation, upstream and downstream from this. So my recommendation is, look, if you're listening to this and you're like, you know, my parents are getting a little older and I do worry about potential fall risk or something, or my grandparents or whatever. Well, you know what? Instead of, you know, saying, well, hey, how can I convince my parents to go to the gym? How can I convince my grandparents to go to the gym? How can I convince them to talk to their doctor about exercise? Damn it, take them. You take them. If you live near your parents, if you have that sort of, you know, that sort of geographical relationship, take them to the gym with you a couple of times, get them settled, or just start training with them. How cool would that be? Like you've trained with your parents a number of times. How cool is that?
Yeah. It was enjoyable and useful to them. And they periodically want to check in and send a video and stuff like that. So it ends up leading to some follow-up and adherence over time.
I saw your parents last week. They couldn't stop talking about training. It was amazing. I got pickles out of the deal. So like, you know, I'm pumped on that. Yeah. I think my general recommendation is, you know, yes, I would recommend exercise for preventing fall risk. I think that we're going to have to increase the dose, increase the duration of that dose. And if you really want to make a difference in your own sort of family or friend group or whatever, you're going to have to take people to the gym. I don't know that you could just outsource this, unfortunately. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, all right.
Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. Summer is nearly here, which means that warmer, sunnier days are calling. Fuel up for them and support your fitness goals with Factor's fresh, never frozen, dietitian-approved meals. Factor is America's number one ready-to-eat meal delivery service and is much healthier than most takeout meals, which tend to be very high in calories due to both the portion size and the ingredients. Skip the grocery stores, the prep work, and the takeout trap and let Factor do the work for you. Now, Factor has options to help fuel you up fast for breakfast, lunch, and dinner with chef-prepared, ready-to-eat meals delivered straight to your door. They're ready in 2 minutes, and they even have protein plus options to make sure each meal has at least 30 grams of protein in it. This summer, get Factor and enjoy eating well without the hassle. Simply choose your meals and enjoy fresh, flavor-packed meals delivered right to your door. Ready in just 2 minutes, no prep, no mess. Head to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Hey everyone, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine here. Want to know one of my favorite sounds? That's the sound I hear when I'm learning a new language with Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. Now, I've been using Babbel for about 2 months now to learn French. On most days, I open the app and I do a review or a new lesson that's been customized for me. Now, my French isn't that great yet, but the spaced repetition learning is really helping, especially since Babbel's tips and tools are rooted in real-life situations and delivered with conversation-based teaching, so you're ready to practice with what you've learned in the real world. They also have speech recognition technology that helped me with my pronunciation and getting the accent right.
Oui, bien sûr.
Oui, bien sûr.
Je m'appelle Alice.
Je m'appelle Alice. We got a very special offer for our listeners. Right now, you can get 60% off your Babbel subscription, only for our listeners, at babbel.com/barbellpod. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/barbellpod, spelled BABBEL.com/barbellpod. Rules and restrictions may apply. Head over to Babbel today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Last paper here on the Barbell Medicine podcast with Dr. Austin Baraki. We're going to talk about, again, I think it's your second favorite thing to blood pressure screening is, you know, diagnosing obesity, screening for obesity. And we're going to talk about the waist to height ratio. Okay. So this paper is titled Waist to Height Ratio and Body Fat Percentage as Risk Factors for Ischemic Cardiovascular Disease, a prospective cohort study from UK Biobank. This was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition in June of this year. So Austin, before we go any further, you want to talk about what ischemic cardiovascular disease is? Because we talk about atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, heart disease, and people talk about like heart health. Where does this fall into that sort of spectrum?
Yeah, I think it's good enough for folks to recognize this as falling in the same giant bucket as the other most common forms of heart disease that we talk about. Ischemic refers to a phenomenon of inadequate oxygenated, you know, blood flow to a particular area. So if you have an issue with getting sufficient oxygen delivered to a part of your heart muscle or to some other area of your body due to a problem with the heart and the blood vessels and things like that, that would all fall under the umbrella of ischemic cardiovascular disease. Could involve your brain, your heart, your extremities, internal organs. All of them can be impacted by insufficient oxygenated blood flow, which can happen for a lot of reasons, but most of the time it's atherosclerosis or plaque that we've talked about a bunch before.
There you go. All right. So for some background information, at present, most national and international organizations recommend using the BMI, so body mass index, and waist circumference to screen for obesity, where a BMI greater than 23 but less than 35 is considered this indeterminate zone in general, meaning that you need a little bit more data to, you know, definitely diagnose somebody with obesity. And so a waist circumference is usually recommended in addition to that, where less than 37 inches or less than 94 centimeters for waist circumference is good for men. If you're above that, that is a positive risk factor for obesity, carrying too much body fat, and less than 31.5 inches or less than 80 centimeters for women is, again, good. And above that would be a positive risk factor for carrying too much body fat. Now, there are problems with both BMI and waist circumference in isolation. There are different sort of waist circumference cutoffs for people of different ethnicities and where they live in the world. And those have not been fully characterized. I don't pretend to say that, hey, those numbers are cutoffs for everyone globally, also for different age groups. So there's been some push to make different waist circumference cutoffs, BMI cutoffs for different ethnicities, different age groups, and so on. But overall, these do a pretty good job. Right. And I don't want to bury the lead here. I think they do a pretty good job at screening for and indicating those who are likely at risk from carrying too much body fat. Still, many take issue with the body mass index. And they say it shouldn't be used because it doesn't take into consideration body composition. They're like, well, it doesn't tell you what your body fat is. Although from that sort of, you know, comment, you would think that BMI would overdiagnose people with excess adiposity or obesity. But in fact, the actual problem with BMI is that it underdoses people with obesity, meaning that when you use a BMI cutoff of 30, okay, if you're above 30, it's, we can say with some certainty that you're probably carrying too much body fat. But if you're below 30, and someone says, oh, I don't have obesity, I'm not carrying too much body fat, I am not certain of that. You're missing about half of folks who have a lower BMI, but aren't over that sort of cut point. And so if you really had a problem with BMI, it says, well, it underdiagnoses people. That would be the big problem, not overdiagnoses folks. So the waist to height ratio has been recommended by some, and it compares your waist circumference to the standing height. It does appear to be better than waist circumference alone or BMI alone, but it's unclear if it's better than combining those two variables. Also unclear if it correlates with body fat accurately or if it can be used for disease risk prediction, because ultimately that's what we're trying to do, right? We're trying to say, okay, based on the evidence that we have on you, the individual, we think that you're carrying a little bit too much body fat, and that likely increases your risk of things like heart disease, in this case, ischemic cardiovascular disease, but it could be other stuff like type 2 diabetes and other sorts of conditions. So this study wanted to see if the waist to height ratio correlated strongly with measured body fat, as well as if it predicted ischemic cardiovascular disease. So the study used the UK Biobank data set. This is a data set that is from a group of about 500,000 folks in England, Scotland, and Wales from ages 40 to 69 at the time of recruitment. That was back in the mid-2000s. So about 468,000 individuals. Body fat was measured with BIA, so that's the handheld bioelectrical impedance, for all folks. And then 34,000 of those individuals had their body fat measured by DEXA to see if there was some sort of appreciable difference that you would have to like do some subgroup analysis. Shocker, didn't really matter. Okay. They also used a waist to height ratio cutoff to basically differentiate between low waist to height ratio, so that would be good, or high waist to height ratio, which would be bad, indicative of carrying too much body fat, of 0.5. So less than 0.5, low, which is good, or greater than 0.5 is high, not so good. Mine was 0.44. Austin, do you know what your waist to height ratio is offhand? Okay, you're muted, but I'm going to say that it's lower than mine because what's your waist circumference, do you know?
Probably around 31, something like that. Yeah.
And how tall are you?
5'10".
Yeah, so yours is probably the same as mine then, as it turns out. We don't look the same, but I think we have a similar waist to height ratio. So you're good. You're still on the low end. As far as the waist measurement cutoffs, they use 90 centimeters for women and 100 centimeters for men. So if you compare that to the waist circumference that I gave earlier, those are substantially higher, which have been published by some other like international working groups, but in general have fallen out of favor because they seem to be a little bit too high to accurately predict risk early enough in the disease course. So you're basically missing a lot of people underdiagnosing with those cutoffs. That is going to come up later. So the reference group for heart disease risk, basically how the group that they compared heart disease risk against, had a low waist circumference and a low waist to height ratio. And they compared those to the three other groups where you mix and match the other two terms. So what were the results? They had an average follow-up of about 12 years and just about 20,000 first-time or incident cardiovascular disease events happened. So that could be a heart attack, that could be an ischemic stroke, or some other sort of ischemic cardiovascular disease. For the waist-to-height ratio, about half of women, 54.3% of women, had a high waist-to-height ratio, and about 78.1% of the study subjects who were men had a high waist-to-height ratio. When compared with those who had a low waist-to-height ratio, there was about a 50% increase in risk of heart attack, stroke, or ischemic heart disease in women. And it was about the same in men, though the risk of ischemic stroke was a little bit weaker at about 20% increased risk. Now, with respect to waist circumference on its own, about 30% of females in the group had a waist circumference greater than 90 centimeters, and about 36% of men had a waist circumference greater than 100 centimeters. When you compared that proportion of folks who had a higher waist circumference to the waist to height ratio sort of cut point, about 100% of those who had a low waist-to-height ratio also had a low waist circumference. So you're like, oh, good. Good agreement. Great. Maybe we don't need the waist-to-height ratio. However, only about half of those with a high waist-to-height ratio had a high waist circumference. And so if you were a proponent of the waist-to-height ratio, you'd be like, well, that's bad, because the waist circumference cut point may miss those who have an elevated risk of disease due to excess adiposity. And that's kind of what I alluded to earlier when I said they use these relatively high waist circumference cutoffs. For example, if you made the waist circumference cutoff 120 centimeters, you know, something much, much larger, you'd say, well, yeah, nobody who's got a high waist circumference had a high waist to height ratio. You know, you'd just be like, yeah, it's a useless, waist circumference is useless. Don't use it. That's just the problem with using the different numbers here. So in any case, every 5% increase in waist to height ratio over 0.5 was associated with a 20% increased risk in cardiovascular disease. So that's heart attack, stroke, or ischemic cardiovascular disease. This was pretty much all due to body fat's effect, as when they corrected for the measured body fat, the effect basically disappeared. So all what this is doing is basically giving us another proxy for central obesity, central adiposity. That just means body fat stored in the visceral abdominal tissue, VAT, if you will, or belly fat, if you want to call it that. So no surprise, yeah, central obesity or visceral adipose tissue or belly fat, yeah, that's a problem. No shocker to us here. The question is whether or not using waist to height ratio improves upon what we're currently doing using BMI and waist circumference, right? It's like, are we really underdiagnosing people by using BMI and waist circumference? Do we need a new sort of more precise measurement of abdominal obesity? Should we use waist to height ratio? My feeling on this is I don't know that the diagnosis or screening for obesity is a real problem, that we're like missing tons of people by using BMI and waist circumference. I don't think that's the case. I definitely think there are issues with BMI and waist circumference in isolation, but I don't think that this is compromising care or management of obesity due to underdiagnosis. And just to kind of like put all that together, people, when they go into the doctor's office, are generally aware if they're carrying too much body fat. They already kind of know this. It's not like a surprise, like, oh, dang, doc, I didn't know. Like, thanks for telling me. That's not usually the response either, right? If I had to identify like the top three issues, you know, for obesity management, it would be the stigma. So that's thing one, right? So people don't even want to talk about it because they already feel like they're going to be attacked. Doctors also, unfortunately, do tend to treat individuals with obesity a little bit different, ascribing maybe more of their disease sort of trajectory and burden of disease to excess body fat than maybe they should. The second problem after stigma is access to care. So people are not accessing medical care or other sort of supportive care to manage their obesity. And a lot of that is due to both stigma and then unsuccessful sort of trials of weight loss or management on their own and not wanting to kind of relive that. And the third is support. We do a really terrible job, not only in this country, but almost globally in developed countries, at supporting those with excess adiposity, excess body fat. We stigmatize them for maybe using medications, right? We look at folks and say, oh, well, they just must be lazy or stupid or something else. That's why they're not taking control of their own life, you know, and achieving this sort of ideal body weight or ideal body composition. We don't have access to places to be physically active, right? Their entire environment is set up for failure, effectively. And rather than being sympathetic and supportive of folks, we're just like, nah, just try harder and leave it at that. And then when individuals do like pull themselves up by the bootstrap and are trying, and are like, I really could use that extra helping hand. Maybe these medications would help, you know, get me on track, make me do the things that I have been wanting to do for years and years and years. We say, nope, can't do with meds, can't do with help. Got to do it on your own, because that was maybe my lived experience. It's ridiculous. So I don't know. I maybe you should have stopped me from ranting on this particular one.
Well, but, you took the rant from me this time. Usually I'm ranting about that topic, but it's all good.
Do you think though, like that waist to height ratio would significantly impact management of obesity? Like, do you think that's the problem?
Yeah, I don't think that it is likely to have a groundbreaking effect on the management. Based on the data you've presented, it seems to, in some situations, offer an advantage over combo of BMI and waist circumference in terms of improving some sensitivity aspects there. And so, you know, one could say, well, let's stick with the tried and true that we're comfortable with, which for the most part is BMI. Most primary care clinics are not routinely measuring waist circumference. the argument you could make based on this paper is you could actually eliminate BMI altogether and just do a waist measurement and then a height measurement, and then you could get all the data that you need with seemingly even better sensitivity than either one alone or potentially even in combination, more broadly speaking. And, you know, getting weighed at the doctor's office itself is an issue for some folks that they would prefer to not go through, and they sometimes avoid care as a result of it and things like that. This is well known. And so, not to say that it's a whole lot easier to go and get your waist measurement, you know, taken, but rather than doing both weight and waist measurement, if all you did was just like, you know, how tall is the person and then do a waist and you can calculate this ratio, and if it gives you better sensitivity for this and potentially specificity than either of those two separately, that's an interesting idea that could alter care and make it a bit less rough for some folks who've had bad experiences. So I find that to be a plausible deal. As far as like, oh, what if say we snapped our fingers and all clinics suddenly switched to this, is like, are rates of like ischemic cardiovascular disease going to drop precipitously? No, obviously not. That's which, if that's the fundamental question, then no. In terms of the healthcare experience and accuracy of diagnosis, I think it seems like it potentially could and save some time too, because you only have to do one thing instead of two.
Yeah. I think like making that argument makes more sense to me. Like, okay, look, we're just going to get a waist circumference. The people are going to self-report their height. That's good enough. We can plug and chug and come up with something that even honestly, if it was less sensitive than what we're, you know, than BMI and waist circumference together, but it is less time and more people do it. Mm-hmm. You could make that argument like, well, now more people are being screened for and being identified. Maybe that's helpful if somebody was maybe on the fence about like addressing this, or there was an indeterminate case where you were like, I'm not really sure because you're kind of borderline across the board. Maybe.
Yeah. And the downside too is of this is that waist measurement is a more skilled metric than having someone stand on a scale. And of course, that's reflected in differences in sensitivity between the two. So, the overall body mass measurement is what it is, yet, there's a correct and an incorrect way to do waist measurements. So that would require training, which needs resources and time and all sorts of other things to get useful data out of it. So things are complicated.
Yeah. I keep going back to this idea, like, I don't know how many people are receiving new diagnoses of obesity at the doctor's office, and they're like, well, I had no idea. Yeah, you know, like I know I've looked into this before. I'm sure I had a previous rant on Instagram at some point about this. I would predict that is relatively low, right? And I don't know that like the waist to height ratio necessarily like does a better job at that or communicating that. And honestly, I really think we need to rebrand obesity. Yeah, you've said maybe like call it hyperappetitism or something before, or like hyposatiety or whatever. And like, fine, let's like remove the physical symptom from the disease
diagnostic
name.
Label. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And like give people some access to better care, better help, and without the stigma. That would be the idea. All right. Well, hey, man. That's a wrap on episode 297. Special shout out to Dr. Austin Baracchi for joining us here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. Remember, everyone here at Barbell Medicine, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.